to pray, but I'm sorry I don't pray that way. Once I ran to you, now I run from you. This tainted love you've given, I give you all a boy could give you. Take my tears and that's not nearly all. Tainted love, tainted love. Don't touch me, please, I cannot stand the way you tease. I love you though you hurt me so. Now I'm gonna pack my things and go. Tainted love, tainted love, tainted love, tainted love. Touch me, baby, tainted love. Touch me, baby, tainted love.
Don't you leave me no more. I've got this burning, yearning, yearning feeling inside me. Ooh, deep inside me. And it hurts so bad. You came into my life so tenderly. With the burning love that stings like a bee. So helplessly, you know I believe you wanna leave me. Oh, baby, baby, where did our love go? Oh, don't you leave me, don't you leave me no more. Oh, baby, baby.
You know I'm a dreamer, but my heart's a gold. I had to run away high so I wouldn't come home low. Just when things went right, it doesn't mean they were always wrong. Just take this song and you'll never be left all alone. Take me to your heart, fill me in your bones. Just one more night, and I'm coming on this long and winding road. I'm on my way, I'm on my way.
Home sweet home.
Tonight, tonight,
I'm on my way,
I'm on my way.
Home sweet home.
Thank you.
103.1 FM.
But the
is above the waistline, sunshine. Watching the game, controlling it. I don't see you guys rating the kind of mate I'm contemplating. I'd let you watch, I would invite you, but the queens we use would not excite you. So you better go back to your bars, your temples, your massage parlors.
One night.
FM.
This week on Viewpoints.
What we're seeing now is that people from all walks of life, people who had jobs, who had homes, who had families, are now going unclaimed.
The growing epidemic of unclaimed bodies in America. Then.
I have a list of 45 ingredients, and 41 of those were functionally extinct.
Did the fruits and vegetables of our ancestors actually taste better? These food historians have no doubt. I'm Marty Peterson.
And I'm Gary Price. These stories in depth this week on your public affairs magazine, Viewpoints.
KFC's new saucy nuggets are here to show you what it really means to have the sauce. These juicy hand-breaded nuggets come drenched and dripping. Get the real sauce. Try KFC's new saucy nuggets, available with Nashville Hot, Georgia Gold, Honey Sriracha, Korean barbecue, or sticky chicken. Dripping in flavor. 10 pieces for just $5.99. Only at KFC. It's finger-licking good. Prices and participation may vary. Tax, tip, and fees extra.
Febreze. Fabric Talk.
Hey, it's me, your couch. Today's my favorite day of the week, Febreze Fabric Spray Day. The occasional deep cleans are nice, but in between, you know I'm needing a refresh. Ooh, here she comes with the Febreze Fabric Spray. Oh, yeah, spritz them armrests. Don't be shy. Nothing like a good spray down to get me smelling so fresh and clean. Don't forget my back. Nice. Febreze Fabric Spray. It's just that easy. Now we can both breathe happy. Febreze. La, 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 la.
Every year, up to 150,000 bodies go unclaimed in the U.S. In many cases, the dead have no living relatives, are homeless, or there's simply no one from the family that will accept the body and the high costs associated with a funeral or cremation. While this issue hasn't gotten a lot of attention, it's only expected to get worse as America's population skews older. One of these stories is that of Lena Brown.
For most of her adult life, lived a middle-class life. She had a paid-off house. She had a flush savings account. She had Social Security income. She lived a very long life. And into her 90s, when her body started to break down and she needed full-time care, she was put in a nursing home by a nephew. And within a couple of years, all her money had been spent out. And she died penniless. She died, as the county determined, indigent, and went into that mass grave, you know, after being cremated by the county. But I think it's sometimes a misnomer or misunderstanding a lot of the press coverage about the unclaimed, that somebody who dies indigent was always indigent.
That's Pamela Prickett, an associate professor of sociology at the University of Amsterdam and the co-author of the book The Unclaimed, Abandonment and Hope in the City of Angels.
The unclaimed are people who die with no next of kin willing or able to claim their bodies. And that means that a local government official, in the case of our book, the County of Los Angeles, calls the next of kin and asks, "Will you claim this body?" And for a number of reasons, the answer is increasingly no.
In general, men typically go unclaimed at a higher rate than women, and the average age is younger than you would think. Most unclaimed people are in their late 40s and 50s. For many of these deaths, there are still living family members out there, but the hard part is finding them.
There is no federal agency to track or oversee the unclaimed. In the United States, death is a very local event. So when it comes to the time of disposition and determine whether or not somebody is going to be claimed, that's often happening at the local level. So you can just imagine, it really depends on how resourced those local governments are. In smaller counties, you'll often find that this is done by a local coroner or a sheriff's office or a justice of the peace, for example. This is common in places like Texas, which have far fewer medical examiners than you would think. And so it's really up to those kind of government officials to determine whether or not they're doing their due diligence.
Prickett and her co-author Stefan Timmermans focus on Los Angeles County because it's one of the few places that have a multi-layered system in place for identifying the bodies and tracking down next of kin.
They'll go through everything in a decedent's property, their home, their apartment, looking for all kinds of clues. The body will then be transferred back to the Department of Medical Examiner. And if no next of kin was easily found by the death scene investigator, they transfer the case to the Department of Notifications. A notification staff is a small group, but they are exceptionally well-versed in Ancestry.com and Accurate and all kinds of different databases, which they use, and they'll enter in kind of any information that they can find, different names, different dates of birth. They get extremely creative. They often will find associates. They'll make calls to neighbors, family, friends, but they're looking for a very targeted definition of what it is next of kin.
In the government's eyes, this means the person's closest living blood relative or relatives. This legal definition can get dicey when there are friends or chosen family members of the deceased who are willing to claim the body but can't because they don't qualify within this definition. One person who understands the complexity and challenges of this search is Chuck Hurick, a senior fiscal scientist at the National Institute of Justice. Hurick is an expert in forensic science and since 2010 has managed the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System, or NAMIS. This federal program is the only national public database that displays missing, unidentified, and unclaimed persons cases. For families searching for their loved ones, it's a vital tool. But unfortunately, the majority of counties don't post the names of their unclaimed dead to NAMIS. Why?
NAMIS is a voluntary entry database. That means agencies don't have to use it. We would like to think that they want to use it because it is such an excellent tool and communication avenue for them to try to get resolutions in all three types of these cases. But we do understand that police departments, medical examiners, and coroner's offices across the United States are extremely resource-strapped. So I think one of the biggest reasons that NAMIS isn't used as extensively as it could be is that agencies just don't have the personnel to do the case entry and then be able to monitor or manage the cases. Police departments across the country are closing cold case units. In many instances, those cold case units work missing persons cases. So it's not that the departments aren't interested in handling these cases. They just don't have the manpower with their current caseloads to get to these cases in a timely manner.
Today, there's legislation in 16 states mandating that medical examiners and coroners must publish missing and unidentified person cases in NAMIS. But this law sadly doesn't extend to unclaimed people who have been identified.
It's still not a mandatory case entry legislation. It's more of a, we would like you to do this and use this system to enter these cases. But there's no penalty if agencies don't. But I think the more widespread knowledge we can provide to everybody involved in using NamUs will help to increase the number of cases. And like any database, the more information that is in the NamUs database, the more we have to compare and the higher percentage of resolutions we will be able to provide.
If county officials fail to find the next of kin or family members of the deceased have been found but won't accept the body, then the unclaimed person's case moves to the next stage.
They'll go into determining whether or not that person has assets. If they do not have assets, then what happens in Los Angeles and in many places across the country is the cheapest disposition possible. And that will be a county cremation, either cremated by the county itself or outsourced to a low-cost cremator. In Los Angeles, one of the unique features of the system that they designed is that they'll hold on to ashes for 3 years, giving next of kin an opportunity to come back and claim. That rarely happens. Once somebody is on the path towards going unclaimed, they very often remain unclaimed.
While most unclaimed people are cremated, Prickett says there is a small sliver who do have assets and end up being buried.
Let's say $50,000. They may receive then a private funeral, which is organized by the public administrator, and that's under the office of the treasury. And there's a lot of pomp and circumstance often in these, but they're really kind of a generic funeral, if you will. It's some of the most sort of depressing funerals I think I've ever been to. They last about 7 minutes. Nobody comes to them but the cemetery staff.
For those who have been cremated, most counties also differ from LA in that they don't hold on to individual ashes for 3 years. The remains are often promptly dispersed into a mass common grave for the unclaimed. This can lead to a lot of heartache for family members who have been searching for their loved ones and find them, but it's too late to claim the body.
There's a lot of Americans who just don't know what's happened to their loved one. And it's, you know, there's a solid chance the person who's gone unclaimed and being able to find where they are is like finding a needle in a haystack.
The U.S. has different databases to help connect these dots, but for the general public, this open access information is limited and scarce. NamUs is a big part of this search, yet so many coroner and medical examiner offices never publish their list of identified but unclaimed dead to this directory. Hurick calls on professionals in the industry to start posting to NamUs and relying on it as a resource.
All of the services that NamUs provides are free. Nobody has to pay for the forensic testing. The investigative and analytical support is at no cost to them. And we just want to be here to help resolve these cases. And as we continue to resolve cases, we want those success stories to be shown so other agencies can continue to investigate NamUs and hopefully start using it.
To find out more about this topic and our guests, head to viewpointsradio.org. This story was written and produced by our executive producer, Amira Zaveri. Our studio manager is Jason Dickey. I'm Gary Price. This segment is brought to you by the Capital One Venture X card. Earn unlimited 2X miles on everything you buy, plus get access to over 1,300 airport lounges and a $300 annual credit for bookings through Capital One Travel. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Coming up, researchers are bringing back long-forgotten American flavors when Viewpoints returns.
I'm getting vaccinated with Prevnar 20, a Pfizer vaccine.
So am I, because I'm at risk for pneumococcal pneumonia.
If you're 19 or older with chronic conditions like asthma, diabetes, COPD, or heart disease, or are 65 or older, you are at increased risk for pneumococcal pneumonia. Ask your doctor or pharmacist about Prevnar 20, pneumococcal 20-valent conjugate vaccine. It can help protect you against pneumococcal pneumonia in just one dose. Even if you've already been vaccinated with other pneumonia vaccines, Prevnar 20 may help provide added protection. Prevnar 20 is approved for adults to help prevent infections from 20 strains of the bacteria that cause pneumococcal pneumonia. Continued approval may depend on a supportive study. Don't get Prevnar 20 if you've had a severe allergic reaction to the vaccine or its ingredients. Adults with weakened immune systems may have a lower response to the vaccine. Side effects include pain and swelling at the injection site, fatigue, headache, muscle, and joint pain. For full prescribing information, please call 1-855-213-2138 or visit Prevnar20.com.
KFC's new saucy nuggets are here to show you what it really means to have the sauce. These juicy hand-breaded nuggets come drenched and dripping. Get the real sauce Try KFC's new saucy nuggets, available with Nashville Hot, Georgia Gold, Honey Sriracha, Korean barbecue, or sticky chicken. Dripping in flavor. 10 pieces for just $5.99. Only at KFC. It's finger licking good. Prices and participation may vary, tax, tip, and fees extra.
I feel like I'm constantly cleaning hair off my bathroom floor. At least my Swiffer Sweeper makes it easy. Sweeper Heavy Duty Dry Cloths have ultra-thick pads to trap and lock hairs, like a hair magnet. And when I'm finished cleaning up my hair, Sweeper takes care of his too. Now the hair's gone, all thanks to Swiffer. Try Swiffer Sweeper Heavy Duty Dry Cloths. I promise you'll love them or your money back. And also try Swiffer Sweeper Wet to make quick work of tough, sticky messes.
When most people think of American food, items like burgers, hot dogs, and pizza come to mind. In fact, American cuisine is often negatively associated with mass production, high sugar content, and ingredients most people can't pronounce. David Shields, a foodie himself, felt this way for many years.
Food was always an issue for me. I was raised actually in Japan, and my palate was formed in the 1950s from Japanese food. So when I came back to the United States in the late 50s, I hated American food. Someone fed me Kellogg's sugar frosted flakes and I thought I'd been poisoned.
Shields is a food historian and professor at the University of South Carolina. He says that this mindset shifted as he dug deeper into the traditional meals and ingredients of various regions.
It wasn't until I went to college down at William & Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia, that I tasted Southern food for the first time. And there was a kind of integrity there that struck me as being kind of analogous to Japanese food.
He soon realized that it wasn't just the special dishes that made Southern food unique, but the ingredients themselves. Many of these items were heirloom crops or older varieties of fruits, vegetables, and grains unique to the region. And they all tasted different than their more modern counterparts. These crops had been cultivated for much longer than the ones in large-scale agriculture, and many were planted generations ago, during a time when food was grown on a much smaller scale. And flavor, not size or durability, was the most important trait.
Modern agronomic breeding puts processability, disease resistance, pest resistance, transportability, quickness to maturation, all of these other sorts of things are elevated above it.
As a result, the tastier heirloom varieties disappeared as mass production took over. In 2003, he was approached by a grain milling company that was interested in restoring older crop varieties. They gave him one task: identify the specific ingredients that made Southern food special. He then spent 3 years combing through seed catalogs from agricultural journals of the early 1800s in search of these forgotten fruits, vegetables, and grains.
2006 comes along and I have a list of 45 ingredients that made up the sort of elemental southeastern coastal foodways. And 41 of those were functionally extinct.
He spent the next 13 years in search of these rare seeds, hoping to bring them out of extinction. Sometimes they could be found frozen in seed banks, which are essentially a library of seeds preserving the genetic diversity of plants. In some cases, the trail had gone cold, and he was ready to throw in the towel. This was the case for the notoriously sweet fruit called the Bradford watermelon.
I got an email. My name's Nat Bradford. I'm growing a patch of the Bradford watermelon in my place in Sumter. Turns out he's a seventh generation descendant of the originator of the watermelon.
Thanks to his work, Shields has been aptly nicknamed the Flavor Saver and is now the chair of the Carolina Gold Rice Foundation, a nonprofit organization dedicated to preserving historic grains, vegetables, and fruits of the Southeast. But what purpose do these older varieties serve other than being tasty novelties?
Right now, people are really hungering, pun intended, for the past and the backstory of the cuisine. So there's intense curiosity getting away from this industrialized product that is out there, and people are trying to figure out, well, what are the various types of collard greens that were grown and what were the features and can we get that taste of our grandparents back?
That's Adrian Miller, a food writer also known as the Soul Food Scholar. He points out how certain regional varieties play an important role in cuisines. Take soul food, for instance, which is rooted in deep culture and tradition.
Over time, soul food has become shorthand for all African-American cooking, but that's really not accurate. Soul food is the food that Black migrants took out of the South during the Great Migration that lasted over decades as millions of African-Americans left the South and started to live in other parts of the country. So this is the cuisine that they transplanted in other parts of the country. So soul food brings together the culinary techniques, ingredients, and traditions of West Africa, Western Europe, and the Americas. So some typical foods would be fried chicken, some kind of fish, usually fried, chitlins or chitterlings, which are pig intestines, smothered pork chops as entrees. Then for side dishes, greens, so dark leafy vegetable greens like collards, kale, mustard, turnip, cabbage, black-eyed peas, mac and cheese, candied sweet potatoes, cornbread, some kind of red drink. It just has to be the color red. I believe that red Kool-Aid is the official soul food drink. Not everybody agrees with me, but most people do. And then for dessert, pound cake, peach cobbler, banana pudding, sweet potato pie.
Today, many African-American chefs and restaurateurs are finding unique ways to reclaim the origins of soul food, while also sometimes adding a modern twist on it.
The most creativity and energy that I'm seeing these days is in the vegan category. See, to a lot of people, vegan soul food is an oxymoron, but I don't think so. Instead of being a departure from traditional soul food, I think it's a homecoming. Because if you look at what my West African ancestors were eating in West Africa, very plant-based diet. Of course, there are protein elements, but plant-based is very important. And if you look at what enslaved African-Americans ate on a daily basis, not on the weekends and special occasions, but just during the week, it's pretty much what we would call vegan today.
If you're looking for these fruits, vegetables, grains, or other regional ingredients, Shields says the best places to look are local markets and even websites like Etsy. To find out more about heirloom foods, soul food, and our guests, David Shields and Adrian Miller, head to viewpointsradio.org. This segment was written by our associate producer, Tabor Brewster. Our executive producer is Amira Zaveri. Our studio production manager is Jason Dickey. I'm Marty Peterson.
Viewpoints returns in just a moment.
Hey, here's a question. After you wear your clothes, you toss them in the washing machine, right? Nobody wants to wear dirty clothes. So how come you don't throw your shoes in the washing machine when they get dirty? I mean, come on. Your shoes are touching the filthy ground all day long. Gross. Well, with Skechers, you can. Because most Skechers are machine washable. That's right. Skechers are specially made so you can toss them right in the washing machine and keep them clean and looking new. And when they look new, you can confidently wear them longer. That's less shoes you're going to want to throw away, which means less waste. And it'll save you tons of dough. I love that. Plus, machine washable Skechers are for the whole family, men, women, and kids. So when your kids get their shoes dirty, oh, and we know they will, just wash them. Brilliant. And even our latest technology, new hands-free Skechers slip-ins are washable. You just step right in and go without bending down or even touching your shoes. So give your Skechers the same treatment you give your clothes. Just toss them in the washing machine and keep them looking brand spanking new. Find machine washable Skechers at a Skechers store, Skechers.com, or wherever stylish footwear happens to be sold.
This is Viewpoints Explained. I'm Ebony McMorris. The departure from organized religion continues to grow across the U.S. In a large-scale survey last year, more than a quarter of respondents identified as having no religion preference. This number is a big shift from the high levels of participation seen 20 years ago. In 1999, 70% of respondents in a nationwide survey conducted by Gallup said they considered themselves to be religious and belonged to a church, synagogue, or mosque. In particular, Catholics and non-evangelical Protestants have lost the most followers over the last 10 years, according to the recent survey by the nonprofit organization Public Religion Research Institute. And this decline will likely continue for years, as both groups are expected to keep losing more members than they bring in. So what's leading to this mass breakup with religion? The number one reason people gave is that they stopped believing in the religion's teachings and beliefs. Another big driver was how their faith negatively viewed and treated LGBTQ plus communities. This was an especially big sticking point for younger respondents. While this decline is most striking here in the States, other countries have also seen a similar trend. South Korea, Iceland, Chile, and Singapore have all reported rising numbers of citizens identifying as non-religious. Jumping back to the U.S., the outlook for religion isn't entirely grim. Among some groups, like Jewish Americans, Black Protestants, and white evangelical Protestants, polls show higher retention rates and followers who are genuinely happy with their faith. But as society shifts, who knows what the religious landscape will look like even a decade from now? That's Viewpoints Explained for this week. More in a moment.
Welcome to Culture Crash, where we examine what's new and old in entertainment. It's been an interesting few months for two superstars of the 90s and 2000s, as audiences receive new projects from both Jennifer Lopez and Justin Timberlake that prove it can be difficult to age gracefully in a pop landscape that's largely moved on to younger artists like Ariana Grande and Olivia Rodrigo. In February, J.Lo released This Is Me Now, a throwback R&B album that was actually received pretty well by critics, but was largely ignored by audiences. The album debuted at number 38 on the Billboard charts, which isn't great. Along with the album, that was heavily inspired by the artist's long history of relationships in the spotlight and her rekindled relationship with Ben Affleck, Lopez released a movie version of the album called This Is Me Now, A Love Story, which was self-funded and released on Amazon Prime Video. If all that wasn't enough, Lopez finally released a documentary called The Greatest Love Story Never Told about the making of the album and movie. And this is the part of the whole project that has captured the public's attention. And that's because on TikTok, the reception has been quite frosty, with many users pulling clips that show Lopez in a bad light, with users accusing the pop star of being self-obsessed. Then in March, Justin Timberlake released his sixth studio album called Everything I Thought It Was, which was released during a tricky time for JT after his ex-girlfriend Britney Spears discussed their own 2000s tabloid frenzy relationship in her memoir, which turned a lot of social media users against Timberlake. Still, he plodded along with his album, and it was released on March 15th to mostly middling reviews. Anecdotally, I will note that I actually find a lot to like on Timberlake's album, even if the runtime is a bit long and a few songs maybe should have ended up on the cutting room floor. Still, his album debuted at number 4 on the Billboard charts, which isn't too bad, but is quite a drop-off from the man whose 4 preceding albums all debuted in the number 1 slot. While Justin Timberlake and Jennifer Lopez were two of the most popular artists of previous decades, their 2024 releases have made it clear that fame alone won't always get artists to the top of the charts. It appears a little bit of aging and a little bit of social media backlash can go a long way in cooling some of that popularity. I'm Evan Rook.
KFC's new saucy nuggets are here to show you what it really means to have the sauce. These juicy hand-breaded nuggets come drenched and dripping. Get the real sauce. Try KFC's new saucy nuggets, available with Nashville Hot, Georgia Gold, Honey Sriracha, Korean barbecue, or sticky chicken. Dripping in flavor. 10 pieces for just $5.99. Only at KFC. It's finger-licking good. Prices and participation may vary. Tax, tip, and fees extra.
It's not just about how you get there, but what you make happen along the way. Introducing the 2024 F-150, a tradition of excellence where strength and adaptability meet. Your journey, your legacy to define. Tough this smart can only be called F-150. Learn more at Ford.com.
And that's Viewpoints for this week.
Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram to learn more about upcoming shows and find a library of past programs on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. Plus, you'll always find previous segments and more information about our guests at viewpointsradio.org. Join us again next week for another edition of Viewpoints.
You're listening to Radio Health Journal, the trusted news source for medicine, science, and technology. I'm Elizabeth Westfield.
I'm Shel Lustig.
And I'm Greg Johnson. This week, reimagining how to live with dementia.
Suppose you had dementia, because I think it's a pretty likely outcome for a lot of us. What would happiness in that circumstance look like?
But first, suicide may be one of the most preventable deaths, but not all suicides can be prevented.
Not every person with thoughts of suicide shows us a sign. They might protect their loved ones and family from that. They might be showing someone else a sign, and it's quite possible there are no signs.
All that and more this week on Radio Health Journal.
Now Martha Stewart for Skechers.
When I make a dish or embark on a craft project, I always use the finest, most fabulous ingredients and materials. Which is why, when it comes to footwear, I love Skechers. Because Skechers is the comfort technology company and uses the most luxurious, innovative materials and designs to make wondrously comfortable footwear. It's exactly the way I'd make shoes. They've meticulously designed stylish footwear with all the fits and features you want. They have fits like wide fit, relaxed fit, stretch fit, arch fit, and more. Plus, they have luxurious features including Skechers' world-famous air-cooled memory foam. It's like walking on a cool side of the pillow all day long. And best of all, they find a way to keep them affordable. You simply can't get more comfort and style for your dollar. So if you want the kind of footwear I'd create, get yourself a pair of Skechers. It's comfort with style and more.
Find Skechers at a Skechers store, Skechers.com, or wherever stylish footwear is sold.
Spring is here and signs of abundant new life are everywhere. It's a time when most of us feel renewed and optimistic. But experts say this season also comes with a shocking statistic. During the month of April, more people take their own lives than any other time of year. The myth that suicide rates reach their peak during the holidays is just that, a myth. Here's another one. Every suicide death is preventable. In fact, no matter how well-intentioned, alert, and diligent people's efforts may be, there's no way of preventing all suicides from occurring, as stated by the Nevada Division of Public and Behavioral Health Office of Suicide Prevention.
We strive for 100% suicide prevention, but people are complex. Hence, suicide prevention is equally complex. We don't know always those signs. We aren't always aware of those signs, but also not every person with thoughts of suicide shows us a sign. They might protect their loved ones and family from that. They might be showing someone else a sign, and it's quite possible there are no signs. I do believe that is rare. Most people do show some indication that they're struggling and having thoughts of suicide or struggling with other mental health concerns.
That's Misty Von Allen, Suicide Prevention Coordinator with the State of Nevada in the Division of Public and Behavioral Health. She says the notion that all suicides can be prevented is hurtful and inaccurate. In 2022, the CDC recorded almost 50,000 deaths by suicide in the U.S., so it's an important distinction to make, especially for suicide loss survivors.
Yes, suicide prevention is a great thing, and I'm glad to see the new hotline number and all of the good work that American Foundation for Suicide Prevention is doing. I would argue that not all suicides are preventable. And perhaps I say that because my daughter's wasn't, and I wasn't able to. So maybe I'm being defensive about it, but I've talked to many other parents who bristle at the idea.
That's Eileen Vorbach Collins, author of Love in the Archives, a patchwork of true stories about suicide loss. Her daughter Lydia took her own life 23 years ago. Lydia was 15 years old.
Certainly, my daughter had mental health issues and had her own clinical diagnoses and was hospitalized. And it wasn't that I didn't see what we like to call the signs. And that's one of the issues I have with the whole idea of getting on the prevention bandwagon. Certainly, we all want to see suicide prevention, and I'm certain that it does work to a degree. It's when I hear that all suicides are preventable that it makes me bristle, because they are not. You know, I worked in mental health. I knew the signs. My daughter exhibited many of them, was hospitalized, had a therapist, was medicated for a while. But at some point, you cannot watch a child 24 hours a day.
As a parent, Colin suffered the common stigma of shame and guilt after Lydia's death. Had she done enough to protect her daughter? Could she have prevented Lydia's suicide?
What kind of parent could I have been? And I think that's what prompted me to write the book, is that I went for years feeling such horrific guilt. And it comes with the territory. It's what people feel. You know, you're gifted with this child, and your job is to protect that child and raise that child. And when it turns out that they take their own lives, you just look back at everything you've ever done or said and wonder, what could I have done differently?
Colin sought help from other suicide loss survivors through various support groups.
If it hadn't been for some of these survivor groups, I don't know how I would have managed. I absolutely needed to find other people who had gone through this. I have so many people in my life because of these support groups who have felt the same, and I'm able to look at them and say, no, this wasn't your fault. You know, you did what you could do. And then finally, being able to tell myself that.
In addition to the myth of prevention, Colin says another misleading idea is that suicide is always a selfish act.
I never thought of it that way. I thought of it as she tried so hard. And when I read her journals, when I read her journals, she fought it for a long time, as young as she was. And I hear this from many other parents. It's not like they did this to hurt us. They did it because they couldn't take the pain anymore.
Rick Strait is the Substance Use Division Director and Suicide Prevention Coordinator for the Community Counseling Center in Southeast Missouri. He's also a suicide attempt survivor.
I struggled with depression my whole life growing up as a child. Didn't know it was depression at the time. And then I lost my brother in a car accident. And that took that grief, that spiraled the depression to the point that I felt completely alone. In retrospect, I know I wasn't alone. I had parents that were also hurting, but I felt like I had to not let them know I was hurting. That way I could be supportive of them. I had a wife at the time, and I had a newborn baby. And I was in the military at the time, so I had a lot of friends that are in my squadron that I, you know, so I knew, like, looking back, I had so many people in my corner, but I just felt like I wasn't. I felt like it was just me.
Fortunately, Strait's mom interrupted his attempt. Though he was initially angry, Strait quickly realized how grateful he was to be alive.
Yes, I was glad, but I still struggle with depression and suicidal thoughts for many, many more years. But after the attempt, though, I had kind of made a promise to myself that I wouldn't attempt again, because I realized how it was going to impact my wife at the time. And so I tried to make that promise to myself that it would never happen again.
Strait says he eventually learned how to talk about his feelings, though it took a long time to be comfortable with. And when he met with other suicide attempt survivors, he realized that so many more people struggle with these thoughts than just him.
Because that was one of the worst feelings about when I was having thoughts of suicide, is I really thought that nobody else would ever understand, that there's nobody else that's ever been through this. And so as I learned over the years that there are so many people who have been through this, so many people have lost people to suicide, so many people have made attempts and lived, and then so many people are struggling with those thoughts and never act on them. And so even though I'm not glad that they struggled also, it was kind of a lightning effect for me when I realized, okay, I'm not alone. This isn't some just messed up Rick thing. This happens. And, you know, the more I learned and how often it happens, it just helped me feel kind of normal. And then eventually I got some counseling and some help to get through the depression.
Today, Strait is doing well, but he still has bad days. The difference is that he talks about his feelings with his family and friends to let them know when he's struggling.
We don't have to spend a whole bunch of time dwelling on it, but it keeps those thoughts from festering and becoming more intense.
Von Allen says many people live with ongoing thoughts of suicide on a daily basis. Thankfully, a lot of them have found successful coping strategies.
There are many people with persistent thoughts of suicide, and they live and work with us and keep themselves safe. When their thoughts start to escalate towards suicide, they have a safety plan that they need to work. And that could be reaching out to a hotline. It could be walking the dog. It could be talking to your support system. They manage those thoughts with individual safety plans, incredible support systems, and often a routine of well-being and wellness that helps de-escalate those thoughts and bring those thoughts back down under balance.
Research shows that suicide attempts are often impulsive. A person might deliberate for 5 minutes or less after having suicidal thoughts before taking action.
It is one of the most preventable forms of death. It is. But again, we aren't always given the gift of time and those signs within that time. There are certain people who might have an event occur that activates thoughts of suicide, and lethal means are readily accessible. One of the most proven prevention strategies we can implement is giving that person with thoughts of suicide space and time away from that lethal means, be it medication, be it a firearm. We give them space and time. Often they can de-escalate. They can reach out for help or someone can intervene. So that's really a crucial element here, but we don't always get that opportunity.
And as suicide rates continue to rise, Von Allen says that prevention is crucial. However, there's always more to learn, especially from people like Strait.
Those who survive their own attempts of suicide teach us how to be better at the work we do with prevention. Under our best efforts and our most diligent work, we can still lose someone that we're trying to help. But the better we get, the stronger our safety net will become.
If anyone listening to this program is feeling depressed or having suicidal thoughts, you can dial or text 988 from anywhere in the country.
Sometimes just talking to somebody that you know that cares and can help listen, and sometimes it can be enough on its own. And they get a trained person, they can ask them some questions and just be there for a conversation. And then most states also have, you know, walk-in mental health clinics as well. I know in Missouri, every county has a Department of Mental Health funded place where people can walk in and they can talk to somebody every day, any day.
And if someone you know is depressed or has shared that they've been having suicidal thoughts, Strait says it's important to be a listening ear for them.
If we can have compassion and listening and ask them questions and then just be present, even if we know it's a suicidal crisis or not, so let's say there is their teenager that brings that to them, just being there and being in that moment and, well, tell me what's going on, and then truly listening. And as a parent myself, it's hard not to try to fix right away. We want to go into problem solve and tell them all the things that are going right. Just listen and kind of shut that parent mode off for a second and just, you know, that writing reflex and just listen. I think that's one of the most powerful things we can do, whether it be any type of mental health thing, whether it be just a bad day and no suicidal crisis, or somebody that's having suicidal thoughts. If we can just take a few minutes and just truly listen to what they're saying and not jump to conclusions.
Colin's book, Love in the Archives, A Patchwork of True Stories About Suicide Loss, is available now online and wherever books are sold. You can learn more about suicide prevention and all of our guests on our website, radiohealthjournal.org. For more behind the scenes, follow Radio Health Journal on Facebook, Instagram, and X. Our writer-producer this week is Polly Hansen. Our lead producer is Kristen Farah. I'm Elizabeth Westfield.
Coming up, dementia is what you make of it. When Radio Health Journal returns.
Is switching your wireless service to Total by Verizon easy?
Totalmente.
And you get unlimited 5G data? $25 a line for 4 lines on the unlimited plan? At an amazing price? With no contracts. Should you switch to Total by Verizon? Definitely.
Totalmente.
Find a store or switch suavemente at totalbyverizon.com. Monthly rate when you activate without a pay, plus taxes and fees. Discount begins the month after you enroll. Additional terms apply. See website for data management practices.
Join Macy's and Trust for Public Land to bring more parks to more people across the country now during Earth Month. Throughout April, you can help turn vacant schoolyards into vibrant parks. Just donate online to Trust for Public Land or round up your Macy's store purchase up to 99 cents and donate the extra change. Give back today and find out how we're helping people and the planet thrive together at Macy's.com/purpose.
Oh. old age is a fact of life, one that's experienced with a variety of attitudes. If we're lucky and remain in relatively good health, many of us will reach well past retirement age. But statistics show that at least one-third to as many as one-half of people who reach age 85 will end up with dementia. That's a sobering reality that many people just don't want to face.
I was very troubled by the reaction to dementia. In my research for the book, I came across quite a few people who I would interview, either caregivers or experts or even just regular people in the world. And I would ask a lot of them, so what would you do if you learned you had dementia? What kind of care would you want? And quite a surprising number of them said, oh, I would kill myself. And I really hate the idea of millions of millions of people thinking, well, that's it for me. I'm useless. There's nothing to do about this. I hate this condition. I hate everything about it. Best idea is for me to kill myself. I mean, just imagine if everybody who had cancer said that. It's a horrifying thought. And this is millions of people.
That's Dr. Tia Powell, professor of psychiatry and bioethics at Albert Einstein College of Medicine and author of Dementia Reimagined, Building a Life of Joy and Dignity from Beginning to End.
I really feel we can do better. And that is why I do think this thought experiment of thinking, suppose you had dementia, and suppose, because I think it's a pretty likely outcome for a lot of us, what would happiness in that circumstance look like? And it, sometimes when I say this, people look at me like I have really lost it. And they will say, do you know what dementia is? Have you ever seen dementia?
For Powell, the answer is yes. And for her, dementia is personal.
Unfortunately, dementia is common in my family, as it is common in many, many families around the country. My mother had dementia, and her mother also had dementia. So because dementia runs in families, that certainly got my attention and got me to thinking about dementia, because, frankly, I'm at risk for it. It's a big public health problem to think about anyway, but it's one that is in a particular fashion aimed right at me.
Dementia is actually an umbrella term for many different types of disorders causing a decline in mental abilities. There's Alzheimer's, Lewy body disease, which Robin Williams had, dementia that comes with Parkinson's disease and with AIDS, as well as many other forms. But despite that, mention the term to just about anyone, and all they can picture is one scenario.
A lot of people, and including a lot of doctors, I find, they picture somebody at the very end stage. They picture somebody who's bedbound, who's mute, who's incontinent, who can't feed herself. They really picture the last few months, the dying end stage of what is typically a very long disease. Dementia can go on for 10, 12, even 15 years. The vast